Retronauts is part of the HyperX Podcast Network. Find us and more great shows at podcast.hyperx.com. This week on Retronauts, this ain't no game, it's a podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I'm your host for this one, Bob Mackey. Today's topic is the 1993 movie Super Mario Brothers. Yes, this week we're ending the month of April, or Marprolel, as I like to call it, with our second podcast about the 1993 live-action Super Mario Brothers movie. So earlier this month on the Patreon, we posted a full commentary for the film. If you want to listen to it, you have to sign up for the Patreon at patreon.com/retronauts at the $5 level. That's available there. But today we're going to be talking about the movie at length with some serious experts on the topic. So let's introduce who is here today on the show. Who is our first-time guest on Retronauts?
First time, that would be me, Ryan Haas, founder and editor-in-chief of the Super Mario Brothers the Movie Archive website.
Welcome to the show, Ryan. And long-time Retronaut, who else is here today?
Hi, it's me, Ray Barnholt.
Koopa straps Toad into a chair.
That's true. I don't know which narrator that is, but it happens in the movie. We'll talk about it soon. But about 10 years ago, not 1 year ago, I did a thing called Retronauts Movie Month. I looked at like the four most popular video game adaptation movies, and we did cover Super Mario Brothers, the movie, back then. But I had an hour to talk about it. I didn't have a lot of time to prepare, so it was what you expected, just a lot of people dunking on a movie that's very easy to dunk upon. But for this episode, I've watched the movie twice. I've dug into so much research on the Super Mario Brothers movie archive, and we have Ryan here with us as one of the two members of that website. So I feel like it'll be a more informative discussion about a movie that is not good, but it is a movie that is very interesting, especially the behind-the-scenes stuff, for sure. So before I continue, I want to ask you, Ryan, what is your relationship with this movie? How far did you go back, and where did your obsession begin with this 1993 film?
So I guess you can trace my history back to the fact that I kind of saw the movie before I was really into the games and then worked my way back. So I remember as a kid, I did not see the movie in the theater. I was born in 87, so I was a little too young for my parents to go take me to see in the theater, but I do vividly remember it coming out on VHS and going into the video rental store in town and seeing the big billboards and being like, oh, that looks awesome. Like, it looks like Batman, but like chrome. And what is that, Dad? And he's like, oh, that's Super Mario Brothers. And I remember them renting it and watching it and not letting me see it because they thought it was like too intense. But then a few years later, it was on TV and it was just the beginning part of the movie where they're still in Brooklyn. And I watched the first 30 minutes and asked Daddy, what is this? And he said, oh, that's the Super Mario Brothers movie. And I was very intrigued with it, and I was in elementary school still at the time, and I was about to go to a friend's house for like a sleepover, and I didn't finish the movie then, but I asked my friend, let's rent that movie tonight. So we rented it, I watched it, and we played the games and stuff by then. So that was where the origin point of me just knowing even then as a kid that like there. Something happened here. There's definitely some kind of translation adaptation thing going on. Yeah. So throughout the years, I just have always been interested in video games and movies and comics and adaptations. That's my day job. I'm a visual effects artist. So this stuff is really interesting to me. And when I was in college, by that point I had, acquired as much Mario movie stuff as I could. And it was around 2007. And that was where internet discourse around the movie kind of started to grow. And like you said, Bob, it's just kind of one of those things where when you would search for it on the internet, you would just get to this point of it being, oh, that movie sucked, or that was weird. But I wanted to know why. And I kept searching for the why. And then around that mid-college era, when I had all this stuff, merchandise and memorabilia and some light behind the scenes stuff, I kind of realized, well, nobody's going to do this if it's not me. So I decided to make the website, just put all this info out there to catalog it, and I didn't really know where it was going to go. But a couple years into it, that's when my partner on the website, Stephen, came in, and we started to interview people involved with the film. And then, you know, that's just one thing led to another. And eventually we've got this gigantic archive of a website that we've interviewed as many people as we can that's involved in the film, from actors to directors to producers. And we've just uncovered so much material and information about the film, and we've been able to support a couple of Blu-ray releases and documentaries and things. And it's just a crazy fandom that that just somehow keeps growing, and there's nothing, we never run out of fun things to figure out.
There are still,
and it's such a fun topic to explore.
There are still so many mysteries left to uncover. And yeah, I mean, it's so easy to do your nostalgia critic style takedown of this movie, but I think it's more productive to watch it and then ask the question why, and then go to your website and you'll find some of the answers, because as we'll talk about it, this is a very compromised production in terms of writing and shooting and special effects. Like, so many things went wrong, and the fascinating stories that come out of those really make this movie worth talking about. So Ray, we met up recently and I asked you, like, well, would you be interested in this topic? I had an inkling and you said yes. So Ray, I want to know, like, what is your relationship with this movie?
Well, I don't even remember. Was I on the one 10 years ago?
I don't recall. I know you're on one of them. I can look it up now while you're talking.
Well, this is the podcast for old men. But anyway, I was just going to say I didn't want to repeat my story, but it doesn't matter, does it? So I was kind of there since the beginning, I suppose. I mean, there were always the little rumors that they were making the movie in the years prior to release, and stuff like Nintendo Power, I believe, and other magazines, newspapers and such. But I still wasn't really aware that they were making a Super Mario Brothers movie until, like, I walked into the local theater to watch something else, and up dangling from the ceiling were, like, the two promotional cards for it and posters and stuff. And I was like, oh my God, what is this? They're finally doing it. And Mario has a beard. You don't understand. It was the illustration on the thing. It looked like he had a beard. And Luigi is clean shaven and all this stuff. Oh my God. And ever since then, it was just like immensely fascinating to me. And I was very hyped for it as like as a 10-year-old, essentially. I was 9 or 10. And I still always liked it. I got as much of the merchandise as I possibly could back then. And
wow.
Watched it multiple times, countless times. And it's just been a part of, I guess, my early gamer life, let's say, along with like The Wizard as well. It's like those early kind of video game-ish movies that, you know, you didn't really think would ever be a thing until they actually happened. And it's just like, wow, this is exciting to me. It didn't matter if it was inaccurate or whatever. It was just like, it's a Super Mario Bros. Movie. I'm going to be into it.
Well, for me, as a kid, I was kind of indifferent towards the movie because as a pedantic little kid, I mean, it's why I'm a podcaster now. when I saw the movie previews for it, what bothered me were all the things that, in my opinion, were wrong. Well, it's like, well, Mario doesn't look like this. And, you know, Luigi needs a mustache. All of these things. There's a laundry list of things that are inaccurate compared to the video game. You could probably find lists of them online. I remember not being interested in seeing the movie because of that, but it was a friend's birthday. We were being driven to the movies, and the choice was between Hot Shots Part 2 and Super Mario Brothers, and it was the Dollar Theater, so this was July. Mario Brothers...
Jurassic Park was out by then. But
that's true. It was not at the Dollar Theater yet, although I didn't see Jurassic Park in theaters, but I saw this in theaters in 1993, believe it or not. But yeah, like, I knew Hot Shots was funny, and I liked the first one, but I thought, I kind of owe it to myself to see Super Mario Brothers. And I saw it in the theater. I don't remember us even talking about it when it was over. And I never really thought about it again until we did that Retronauts in 2012. And that's my relationship with the movie. Like, I didn't find it insulting, or I didn't think it was like the worst thing ever. I just thought, well, this is a weird experiment, and Nintendo made sure it never happened again for a reason. And then for this podcast, I'm realizing, like, oh, here are the reasons why it is the way it is. And that's really fun to talk about. But yeah, this was never in the back of my mind. It's like, oh, it's like The Room or Plan 9 from Outer Space. It's so bad, it's good. I never thought of it like that. I never thought of it. But it's a really a fascinating movie at the end of the day. And I'm sure we'll talk about the many details that tell us why very soon. So, I encourage everyone to go to the Super Mario Brothers the Movie Archive at smbmovie.com because I normally send out notes for these episodes to our guests, but in the case of this, I did make my own notes for the outline, but essentially all of the primary sources and secondary sources are on that website. So I didn't want to send Ryan quotes from his own interviews or anything. And that felt kind of insulting to me, but there's a lot of stuff going on there. I do want to start, you know, dissecting the movie in order. And I do want to talk about pre-production because, I mean, normally movies go through a process. It's not uncommon for there to be multiple writers attached to a project, multiple drafts of a movie. But I believe, Ryan, there were like possibly up to 8 different versions of this in production. Can you talk about like the steps that it took? Because I know like even I get confused trying to break it down because there are so many steps along the way. And then old writers coming back on to carve chunks out of the movie while it's being filmed. Right. There's right. So much going on there.
Yeah. So I'll try my best to not monopolize the podcast with the history, but there is so much of it. It's such a, the making of the movie is pre-production of the movie, the production of the movie and the movie itself and the reception of the movie are like gigantic topics, which is why the website exists to wrangle this beast of an event. So it being the first video game adapted into a movie, you track the production of it that, there, you kind of see why it wound up the way it did. These people are just pioneering, trying to figure out how do we do this? You know, what is this? And it starts with the producers. You know, you've got your Roland Joffe and Jake Eberts working together to secure the rights for the film. And Roland Joffe is not the first person you would expect to try to land the rights, the film rights for Super Mario Brothers. I mean, he's a very serious film director, done the Mission and Killing Fields and things like that. And so, but he didn't want to direct it. He just wanted to produce it. He was trying to start to dip his toe into the producing side of things after directing for a long time. But they were up against, you know, the bigger studios like Universal or and things like that. But they were able to secure the rights because they did this traditional approach. Roland Joffe flew to Nintendo and met with the president of Nintendo and you know, just did things their way. And they seemed to really respect that and respect that angle. So they gave him the rights to the movie for a lot less than a lot of people thought that Nintendo would let them go. The big thing was that Nintendo's big thing at the end of the day at that point was, we trust you, you're the filmmakers, make the movie, but we'll take all the money from the merchandising. We care about that. So that's why the filmmakers had so much latitude, is because at that point Nintendo thought, well, we're the game people, you're the movie people, we trust you, just do your thing, see what happens. They let it be very experimental, and it's pretty much to be applauded. I mean, that's one reason why the film is still in conversation after so long. So it started with the pre-production, the getting the rights. And so they started getting a writer and trying to attract talent. The first writer on the project was Barry Morrow, who wrote Rain Man. And he wrote this very introspective, strange script, like an existential road trip, kind of wizard-ish, kind of not much like the game script, but they were trying to attract talent. It's actually the script we have the least amount of information on. Barry Morrow actually just talked about it for the first time a couple years ago when the film hit its, you know, one of its most recent anniversaries. So that script didn't last too long. And then they jumped to the Jim Genuine, Tom Parker era, which a lot of people are very interested in because that is the more fantasy game-like version of the movie. And we have versions of those scripts on the website. And at that time, they paired that script with Greg Beeman as the director. And he was doing Mom and Dad Save the World at the time. And then the story goes that there was a test screening of that movie, and that movie didn't do well. And then the producers kind of thought, I don't know if this is going to really appeal, have the wide appeal. It's like a movie. If we make this, it's going to be goofy and just for kids. We want to broaden the audience. We don't know if this is the right take. It's going to just be like the Mario Super Show on the big screen. That's not really what we want to do. This is the movie. So then they were already pretty deep into spending money on trying to get it off the ground. It was my understanding they We've got concept art from that era. We've got set mock-ups, really cool stuff, images on the website about like fourth perspective things they were trying to do to make it really cool. But they sunk a bunch of money into it at that time, but then scrapped it at that point. And then the hunt was on for now we just need directors. We just need visionary directors to shepherd what this thing is. And then that's when they were able to get Rocky Morton and Annabelle Jenkel on board, who of course were very hot at the time because of their involvement in the creation of Max Headroom. And they were, you know, music video directors, and they were very into technology and emerging like CG stuff. They even worked together on a computer imagery book. That's, I think, maybe even the first book on computer graphics that was actually published, maybe, I believe. It's a giant copy table book. So they gave the project to them. They were the ones that actually that came up with the whole concept of, let's tell the real story of the Mario Brothers. And the game was made after, and they came up with the idea of the evolution and the dinosaur world and stuff like that. And then from that era, they were paired with the original two writers of their version, which was Terry Runte and Parker Bennett. And then that was a very goofy, not goofy, but it was a very broad, expensive, crazy script. And they were newer screenwriters.
Yeah, I was going to mention that it looked like the directors assigned to the movie, they had directed one traditional movie before this, and that was the remake of DOA
mm-hmm.
in 1988. Yeah. So not like the most sure thing. And so, like I said, a lot of interesting stories came out of the research for this, and one of them, I mean, it feels kind of insulting to call it interesting, but I read your interview with the one of the writers, Parker Bennett, one of the credited writers. And I was like, oh, what else did he do? Oh, not much else. What about his writing partner? Oh, it looks like he passed away. And looking into that brought me to like a very shocking story where he was murdered shortly after this movie was made. And in a pretty brutal way, and it seemed to derail Parker Bennett's writing career entirely. And I mean, it kind of messed me up for a little bit. I was just like, wow, it's not expecting a story that dark to come out of the Super Mario Brothers movie.
Yeah, it's a very sad story. And Parker is such a lot of these people I've got to meet in person. We've held through the website the screenings of the film, and I've got to meet Parker, and he's been to some of the screenings we've had. He is such a great guy, and he's got great stories. And he actually has recently launched a website for Terry. And he's been telling stories and posting writing work that he's done to kind of keep his memory alive. It's really kind of a great memorial.
Yeah, I did see that. Like, the bittersweet ending to this story is that his friend did build this memorial to him much later in life. But it's very tragic to see these two young writers working on their second movie, where they could have gone if this tragedy didn't happen to them. But again, a story I did not expect to come out of the Super Mario Brothers movie.
Yeah, so they surprised me. There's a lot of stories.
Yeah,
hit every emotion.
Yeah, so those two guys were very instrumental in trying to add the video game stuff back into the movie. You know, the directors had their high level spin, but Parker was the guy. He was like a cartoonist also, so he was, you know, making doodles next to the script pages on like, well, this is how the coin boxes could work, and this is how this could be like the games and stuff like that. But their script was too broad, and it was too unmovie like to wrangle in, and so that's when the producers and directors needed to kind of, I don't know, harder edge or class up or get it into more of a filmable state, and that's when they brought in the Dick Clement and Ian LaFrenée writing duo.
So joining us mid-show is Stephen Applebaum, also from the Super Mario Brothers Movie Archive. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Hey, great to be here. Happy to have me here.
And we heard from everyone up front, including me, how they found this movie. Can you talk about your relationship with the movie and your obsession with it?
Yeah, I was like most kids, grew up in the 90s, loved Super Mario series. Something about that fantasy setting just appealed to me. And my mother, knowing that, you know, I was into Super Mario, she recorded it off TV for me, a TV series airing. So it had commercials and everything. She drew a little Mario on the VHS label, and I had never heard of the movie before, but, you know, she gave it to me. It was Mario. I accepted it for what it was. And it wasn't until I was much older that I revisited it, and I found Ryan Haas's website, and I began this deep dive. And ever since, I've been a big fan and probably more of a researcher.
Well, a custom VHS tape, a custom label. That's very adorable.
Yeah, I still have it, actually. I keep it right next to my other dozen VHS copies.
Maybe if my dollar movie theater ticket had a little drawing on it that was done for me, I would have liked the movie more when I first saw it in 1993.
Maybe.
But Ryan, you were talking about the next group of writers that were brought on after like the broader, wackier script by Bennett and Runte.
Yes, yeah. So once Dick, Clement, and Neil Frenay were brought in, and we actually, just a couple of years ago, finally got to have a good Zoom interview with those guys on their experience and on our YouTube channel. They were brought in to kind of wrangle the script, get into a filmable state, and basically put a lot of good character work. The previous script was had a lot of really good like world building, but the characters were just kind of all over the place, would come and go, and they didn't have like a good story, like, you know, backbone kind of thing. And so they really worked on a lot of the characters. That's where some characters that non-game characters like Lena really started to take shape. And that's where a lot of the interpersonal relationship between Mario and Luigi and Daisy kind of get there. And that's the script that attracted most of the talent, you know, like your Fiona Shaw and your Bob Hoskins. And so then right before filming is when they got some final financing for the film, and that's when it was decided that, you know, that Disney bought the film and it'll be distributed through Hollywood Pictures, and that's when the mandate to have another script revision to get more family friendly elements in, like bring this down, make this a little less adult. And so that's when only a couple weeks, that's where you got your like Ed Solomon, Ryan Rowe came in. Ed Solomon's pretty popular, worked on Bill and Ted, Men in Black. And he had to very quickly have a hit list of things that he needed to accomplish, and worked on the script to bring it to a producer approved level. And that was handed in without the directors didn't get a say in what that script was going to, the changes. Basically, they were ready to film the other script, and it was just a couple weeks before filming. So they had to kind of work on the fly to figure out they were even still going to make the movie or if they were going to walk away as directors, and they decided to stay. But then that's kind of set everybody off. The movie was in flux. And then when they were filming the movie, that's when they brought the original two writers of their iteration, Parker and Terry, back on set to do the daily changes and rewrites. And they even came back later to work on the extensive amount of ADR that was another whole pass of like trying to shape the film after that.
Loot drop incoming. Get to the drop at HyperX.com for store-wide savings. It seems like everything these days is getting more expensive, and HyperX is doing its part to fight the battle with deep discounts across all categories of HyperX gear. Head there quick, though. Once March ends, so does the madness. It's the HyperX Loot Drop 2, going on now at HyperX.com.
Yeah, it sounded like everything got off on the wrong foot. It also sounded like the directors were kind of checked out before. I mean, at some point in the movie, they left and the movie was filmed by like the second unit director, it sounded like.
Yeah, they were asked to leave, basically.
Yeah.
They filmed, they were directors. They had the vision, but they were inexperienced in working on something this gigantic.
Right.
The first person we interviewed was Mojo Nixon, who played Toad, and he told us about his first day on set. It was very hilarious. Though he said, I walked in and they were filming this car chase and things were exploding all around me, and I was just looking at Rocky and he just looked like, what the hell did I get myself into? And it was just a really interesting, I mean, and everybody I've talked to that's worked on the movie has stories like that. Like, it was crazy. You don't even understand. It really was. it's a miracle it got made, and it's as cohesive as it is.
Yeah,
so, yeah, they were inexperienced, and so back at some point they were asked to leave so they could finish the film and get it done, basically.
Yeah, it sounded to me like, I don't want to speak for the directors, but it sounded like they're in over their heads. And also, they didn't get to make the movie they wanted to make, so they were a little checked out. And I remember I was reading your interview with the actor who played Spike. I forget his name. But it made it sound like they had all these ideas for their characters, but the directors were just like, just do whatever. And it sounds like a lot of the movie, an astounding amount of the movie, was like improvised on the day of filming, especially the characters of Iggy and Spike, who were not reading what was on the page. They were coming up with their own bits together, Fisher Stevens and the other actor. And even the turn in the movie where they become smart, that was just their idea. They'd improvise on the set, and that just changes the trajectory of the movie entirely in terms of where those characters end up and their fates that we see in the stinger.
Yeah, do you want to talk about that, Stephen? You're the Iggy and Spike experts, basically. Because their characters have a very crazy trajectory, and we even have deleted scenes that can also completely change how they can be perceived.
Yeah, Richard Edson, who had played Spike, he was previously a founding member of the band Sonic Youth, probably best known for parts in various films like Ferris Bueller's Day Off as a parking garage driver. But he had experience with music, lyrics, writing, that kind of thing. He was very invested in the character, especially when he realized that, hey, we're going to do a dance club, nightclub type scene. So he developed this revolutionary rap for him and Fisher Stevens' character to sing. He recorded it on a little tape recorder, and he set up a boombox, and they went up to a Rocky and Annabelle while they were setting up a shot or a scene. It's like, hey guys, we put together this song and we thought maybe you'd like it. Maybe if you feel it's good enough, we can put it in the film. And they're like, yeah, just let us listen to it right now. We'll let you know how we feel. And they did it right there on the spot. Everyone stopped, had a listen. And when they were done, they're like, we love it. Let's put it in. Why not? And it made sense at the time because, as Ryan had mentioned, they brought back the original writing pair. They were desperate for writers. They needed people to get you from point A to point B. There were so many threads in the film that were frayed because of the constant rewrites that by the time they got to filming, they realized it wouldn't make any sense to get, story-wise. And in terms of Iggy and Spike, their characters had been severely written down. Same with Mojo Nixon's Toad. Toad was supposed to survive all the way to the end of the film, but to, save on time, story, they didn't want to pay the actor too much. They had him de-evolve almost instantly into a Goomba. So most of the story that would have gone to the unevolved Toad, they ended up shifting over to Iggy and Spike's characters. So although Richard Edson and Fisher Stevens were pitching new ideas for their characters, it sort of already fit the original script that the directors and writers had agreed upon. So they're like, everyone wanted to try to get back to where they were, to the scripts that they had agreed on, that they had signed on. No one was happy to get that Ed Solomon script when they arrived on set. No, they didn't agree to it. So it was a very collaborative process for the actors and the directors and the returning on set writers to try to get it back to where it was. And everyone was happy to do that. They weren't satisfied with the script they were given. It was a good opportunity for them to do that.
Yeah, in terms of actors, it felt like, based on all the materials I read, Bob Hoskins, probably one of the most angry people about this movie, but the one who hit it the best. Dennis Hopper did not hide it very well. But one thing I wanted to mention, I want Ray's feedback on this as well, is that rewatching the movie, it's interesting to see not just how off-brand it is, but how little it actually references the products that this movie is trying to also market to you, where I feel like with the Illumination movie coming up this year, Nintendo has a very watchful eye on this, saying, you know, Goombas can do this, Koopas can do this, they can't do that, a lot of rules. It's interesting to see the mishmash of references, because reading your interview with Parker Bennett, he had not played Super Mario World. A lot of the things in the movie are from Mario 2, at that point a five-year-old game. So, and there's like a reference to the golf game as well, like the Koopahari Desert. So you have Ba-Bombs, you have Koopas, you have Goombas, but despite it taking place in Dinohattan, there's very little Mario World in here. And at that point, that was the newest main Mario game.
I think you're right on that. And it goes back to something I wanted to also talk about, what Ryan was mentioning, the attitude during the development of the movie, which was like, this isn't the cartoon, this is a movie. And I feel like that must have been inspired by like Batman, but also more particularly like the Ninja Turtles movie, where, you know, the Ninja Turtles and Mario are two different things, essentially. Like, Ninja Turtles cartoon is pretty goofy, but Mario games are probably even goofier. So it was very strange to, you know, hear that, you know, and eventually we did get a movie that's really not like that. It is a movie. It is not the game. It is not the cartoon. And I just think that was really fascinating. And it seems to be just like a prevailing attitude during those years of like the late 80s, early 90s, where like you take these big, let's say kids franchises, and you try and just grow them up a little bit and make them, you know, inaccurate on purpose, I guess is one way to put it. And it really goes to show you how soon things changed, like almost immediately after this movie. Like, I think the next big franchise example would be like the Flintstones, and that leaned so hard into the cartoon. And
that movie was written by Tom Parker and
Jim. Yeah. Okay, there you go.
Yeah, some of the same writers.
There you go. So, I mean, it really goes to show how things really changed, I guess, for the better in terms of accuracy. And, like, yeah, now we have, in the past, you know, maybe 15, even 20 years, we have things that are more accurate to the franchises they're based on. And it seemed like the Mario movie was just, like, this weird, like, cliff or, like, midpoint where, like, everything was ready to change in terms of, like, the attitude from Hollywood about these franchises. And
yeah.
I find that really fascinating.
That's a great point, Ray, because I feel that, I think in a negative way, studios are too focused on pleasing the fans. They want all the fans to be happy. It's funny how this movie doesn't care about any of the fans. It's just, like, the tagline is this ain't no game. Me as a fan of the games, it's like, no, I'm here for the games. And like you said, with Ninja Turtles, I think the tagline was even something similar, like, yo, dude, this ain't no cartoon or something like that, where I feel like part of it probably was also appealing to the parents, saying this is different than we have Mario at home or we have Ninja Turtles at home. This is a different experience. But people just want a bigger experience of the things they get in their house now. They want the faithful adaptations. And I think you're right, like, Flintstones was a big turning point. Even something like The Addams Family, which is a great movie, that has a very strange twist in that the idea is there's like an imposter fester that they quickly rewrite into being the real thing. But even then they were like, let's shake things up. Let's make one thing majorly different.
Exactly. Exactly.
To your point, Bob, we have a promotional guide that shows how the film is supposed to be marketed, you know, from, you know, Hollywood Pictures, and there are specific things in there from Nintendo. Like, Nintendo did get all the merchandising rights, but they were also very strict about, when you market this, market it as the movie. You have to put movie stuff in it. Don't put the movie and put images of like the game characters in it. We don't want any game stuff associated with the movie. I don't know if it's like just in case the movie's bad or that was just kind of a stipulation.
Yeah, it was also an earlier time, too, where, I mean, I think games are still getting over this, but there was sort of a stink to games where it was like, oh, this is the newer, lesser medium where you're not going to get the video game stuff in this movie. You're going to get a movie style experience here. So maybe they were aware of that, that bias against games that was happening in the early 90s when, you know, it was a much more controversial and new medium than it is now, when kind of like everyone just plays video games and we're fine with it.
Yeah, that's actually one of the reasons the directors have given for why the film failed. They felt that they were unfairly judged for it being a video game adaptation, that parents just didn't understand what they were doing, and you know, that as a genre, as a medium, it was still had yet to mature. And they felt that parents hadn't appreciated it. And it was just, you even get the sense of that in the reviews at the time. There's a lot of reviews talking about how the game is nonsensical, blipping and beeping and jumping, and you can't really track it. And the film's the same way.
I mean, watch Siskel and Ebert's review. It's like they're really trying to make sense of, like, what is this crazy thing we just watched? I mean, it's very interesting.
Yeah, I think in a way people really overthought the Super Mario Brothers concept, where it's no stranger than something like Alice in Wonderland. But they were overthinking, like, well, how do we turn this into a movie? Well, there's enough elements there that you don't really have to rewrite too much. I mean, there was not a lot of Mario canon in 1991 or 92. There's a lot more now. I mean, you can buy the Mario Encyclopedia. You can look at the wikis. That wasn't happening then. There was like the Mario Mania guide, and that's basically it. But still, I think they were really overthinking the idea of what is the Mario story.
I think it's extra funny because, like, the story, I mean, the canon that existed was basically the cartoon to begin with. Like, Mario and Luigi are two plumbers from Brooklyn, and they get sucked into a different world. That's essentially what I think every approach, maybe not every approach, but a lot of the scripts even we're going with. And it's just like, that was it. And you don't think about that, I guess, when you're a parent as a bystander, just watching the bleeps and bloops. But it's like, that's all I had, really. It's kind of funny.
Yeah. And that's been my chief thing when people, you know, the youngsters complain about, why don't they call the Princess Peach? And then that's because there was no Peach in the United States. Then had to come up with it. But I'm not going to call her Toadstool in the real world. So,
yeah.
Oh, thank goodness. There's Daisy in Mario Land. So
we'll yeah.
There's one other woman in this game series. Let's use her name instead. And going over the research for this, it made me realize, like, oh yeah, this movie was first at bats. I mean, there were movies based on fake video games. There was like Tron and The Last Starfighter. This is the first movie to be based on a game. I guess a game series, but still, I mean, because right after this we have Street Fighter, we have Double Dragon, we have Mortal Kombat, but this was the first one to do it. So you can see, like, they should get a lot of credit just for, you know, charting those new waters, when you would see things like Mortal Kombat played a lot safer, be a lot more closer to the canon and the storyline of what was going on in that game.
Yeah, and Mortal Kombat especially benefited from that greatly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like everything made after this movie was made as a reaction to it in terms of video game movies. Like, this was people doing it for the first time, but now we know, like, what the audience wants, for sure.
And in some weird way, I always feel like it's a little weirdly ahead of its time. In a lot of ways, it is ahead of its time. You track other movies, like, and I love it when Retronauts talks about Batman and Batman games, but when you get to things like Batman Begins, you get to the, oh, we've seen comic book interpretations before. What happens if you take Batman and try to explain everything? Well, that's kind of what they did with Mario Brothers. The game, what happens if the game was real, and let's explain it all. Let's take what the story says, the NES manual, and explain that.
Yeah, it's funny and interesting how so much of this canon was made up by Westerns, in the Western world, where the whole Plumbers from Brooklyn thing was, from my understanding, really an American invention. Sort of like how in the early days of Sonic the Hedgehog, there were so many different Sonic canons. There was like the comic, the two cartoons, what was said in the game, what was said by like Sega marketing. It was them
British
just
comics.
The British comics too, the way different. Yeah, like it did feel like going in this movie, I knew where Mario came from based on what the cartoons told me. It's like Mario, you know, got sucked down the drain, as the rap tells us all at the beginning of Super Show. And then you can see after this movie, Nintendo quickly pulling back from that idea, where no more cartoons, no more adaptations. And then we get to Yoshi's Island, and the retcon is Mario and Luigi are from the Mushroom Kingdom. And then now these days, Nintendo denies, like, Mario is not a plumber. I don't know where you heard that. It's yeah. We didn't.
And
we never told you
aren't
that.
Really the kids either. You know, the manual.
Yeah. Exactly. But I mean, I don't know if it was in reaction to this. I think it was just in terms of like to build a stronger brand. They needed a consistent like IP mythology to speak in like cynical corporate terms. But it is funny to see like all the Brooklyn stuff is over pretty much in the mid 90s. And I do want to talk about some of the casting choices. So Bob Hoskins, an interesting choice. He was not a family movie guy. There are a few exceptions, and this is one of like maybe three or four, because of course this movie has some serious Roger Rabbit energy. This is a special effects comedy, not on the level of Roger Rabbit in terms of the money and the talent involved and the amount of effects, but it's still in the same realm. And I understand that's why they got Bob Hoskins. Also, he looks like Mario. I mean, I don't know if Danny DeVito was in the works, if there were discussions, if he was too expensive, but it's one of two instances in which people want Danny DeVito cast as a video game character, but it never pans out. The other one was Detective Pikachu, which that never happened. And it's been very heartwarming to see John Leguizamo, who this was like one of his first big roles. Like he was acting probably like a decade before this even, but it was heartwarming to see that he does not think it's a good movie. He didn't really enjoy his time on the movie, but he looks back on it fondly as like, oh, somebody gave this Latin American kid this role. Like, when you think of Luigi, you do not think of John Leguizamo. When I think of John Leguizamo's career, I have to remind myself that he did this. And it's been kind of nice to see him look back fondly in some somewhat recent videos and in the documentary This Ain't No Game. The interviews there were pretty eye-opening, the aspect of how much this changed his career.
Yeah, I think also he was just more aware of the fact that people are now appreciating this movie more in recent decades. So, yeah. I think that leads to him just, you know, not being a sourpuss about it.
Yeah, and it didn't destroy his career. I don't think it destroyed any careers outside of maybe the directors who did not really do much directing after this. And, of course, we have Dennis Hopper as King Koopa. An interesting choice again. I don't know, Ryan and Steve, do you know any other alternate casting choices? I mean, I've heard Tom Hanks for Mario or Luigi. That sounds outlandish now, but this is pre-Philadelphia Tom Hanks. That's how Toy Story got Tom Hanks, because his career was considered over. Like, yeah, you made some fun comedies in the late 80s, buddy, but it's over for you now. But I'm curious, like, what other choices were out there for the cast for the casting of this movie?
So there's a lot of books and things that had been written, which seemed to throw out like not super accurate information, but we actually acquired legit early documents that show the lists an or prioritized order of who they wanted for the film. Steven, I believe, has that stuff memorized way better than me, so I'll let him grab it. But the producers really, really wanted Michael Keaton as whoever Michael Keaton would be. They had him like early top picks for Mario or Koopa. They really wanted him. In the fantasy version, they really wanted Arnold Schwarzenegger to be Koopa. They even have concept art of what Schwarzenegger would look like with like prosthetic stuff. But Steven, does any major stuff come to mind for the film that got made or other alternate choices? It was Tom Hanks's Luigi, actually, right?
Yeah, Tom Hanks was considered for Luigi. What's interesting is that they had potential pairs. So even if they considered one actor for Mario, if they consider them for like Luigi, they'd have to get a completely different set of pairs. So they had all these different potential pairs, and you know, they were considering Keanu Reeves as a like a younger Luigi, John Turturro as a slightly older, more Italian Luigi. They were getting all over the place in terms of actors. Bob Hoskins was, in terms of the sci-fi film that we got, he was always the top choice for Mario, and John Leguizamo was always the top choice for Luigi, because the writers had seen him do his one-man show Spikorama, and they just felt he perfectly encapsulated that New York vibe, that young Gen X aesthetic that they wanted for the character. But Christian Slater was a choice for Luigi.
We'd have a sarcastic Luigi at that point.
Actor of the time was considered for Luigi.
Oh, sorry. I was talking over you, Steven. I apologize. What was the last name you said?
I said pretty much any hot young actor of the time was considered for Luigi. But they had a much narrower list for Mario and Bowser. Like they really truly had someone in mind for those characters, and they didn't want to, diverge from those visions too much. Bruno Kirby was considered for Mario, but unfortunately he passed away not long afterwards. By the time the film was actually produced, it seems like they got most of who they wanted. Ironically, Dennis Hopper isn't really on the lists for anyone. It seems like they only got him to play Koopa because he had a pre-existing relationship with Wilmington, North Carolina, where they would film the film. He already had a place there. He was setting up like different clubs. He loved
art, arts installations. And
He just wanted to be there, hang out with that particular up and coming film and artistic industry. And he felt the film was a good opportunity to do that. But unfortunately, it almost seems like because of the film, it gave him a bad experience and he didn't really return to Wilmington too much afterwards.
It tainted the entire state for him. I'm glad you brought it up because going over all the details of this, this movie filmed mostly in North Carolina. Do you know where they filmed the exteriors, like the Brooklyn-y style exterior shots?
Also Wilmington.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Although they did get some coverage shots of New York with like second, third units that they could fill in, but the actual on the street stuff was filmed in Wilmington.
Okay. Yeah. So the movie filmed in North Carolina. I think a lot of the reasons why things happened the way they did, they're way off the radar of Hollywood. But because of that, they built this incredible set inside of a cement factory, Dino Hatton. Even if you don't like the movie, it is a fascinating set to just look at all the details of because we're living in the year 2022. It's been like this for a long time. But when you see a movie now, nothing is real. Light is actually not hitting objects. You're just in a green void. And sometimes people make that void look compelling. Oftentimes it doesn't work out. But we're still in an era in 1993 where you have to build everything. You have CGI. It's very limited. There's a few little funky scenes in this, but they can't actually build a set out of it. So the one major appeal of this movie is production design, and it's very off-brand for Mario, but it's the same production designer as Blade Runner and Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and it's extravagant. Like, looking at these sets, they are just so wonderful, and it's fun to see actors in a space after being the opposite of spoiled by modern movies, by modern action movies.
Bob, I think to go back, you were mentioning how there were a few references in the movie overall, but like we could have seen a lot more, I think, because all the signage on that set is like a game reference, some name to something. It's really quite cool. I wish you'd seen more of it.
We've spent a lot of time categorizing all the references in the production design. And the production designer, David L. Snyder, who's the art director on Blade Runner, he is so great, and he's dedicate a lot of time and energy and effort into helping us catalog things. And he saved all kinds of stuff that he sent us that we've thrown up on the website. And you just look at the before and after pictures of what they were able to do with that cement factory. And it's just absolutely incredible. And everybody that we've talked to that's worked on the movie would say like, it was hot and awful to work on the movie, but just stepping into that thing, it really was like being in another world. And the fact that, you know, when you see shots in the film where it starts on the street and it goes up into Koopa's apartment. That's all real, like in shot. Like they had the cars in the factory on the street, and then that's a street set, and then right above it is Koopa's apartment, and it all works and it all makes sense.
Yeah, David had even said that the sets that he had to work with on Super Mario Brothers were so much more than he had with Blade Runner. I mean, you wouldn't really get the sense of that. I feel like Blade Runner does much better with his sense of scale. But for Super Mario Brothers, in interviews at the time and since, he was very excited about the opportunity to have an actual structure to build onto and into multiple levels. And as Ryan said, when the camera pans up from the street level into a Koopa suite, that's all real. That's multiple levels.
Yeah, and it sounded like the budget really did spiral out of control. This was going to be a much cheaper movie. I think originally planned at around $20 million, but then like almost three times as much was the final cost of the movie.
Yeah, they spent so much just paying for spec scripts. They got Barry Morrow of Rain Man to do a spec script. They wanted something existentialist, very realistic. From what we've heard, unfortunately, we don't have the script, but from what we've heard, it was going to be a road trip with an older Mario and his mentally challenged younger brother Luigi as they bond. And, you know, everyone on the production who had read it, they're like, this is like Rain Man. This is pretty much Drain Man. It just wasn't what they were going for, but they wanted the prestige attached to the script writer. Unfortunately, that it didn't pan out, so they moved on to the fantasy production. And once that didn't work out, and they brought on Rocky and Annabelle to do the sci-fi vision, they still counted those previous spec scripts in terms of the development budget. So when they finally started filming, they're like, we're already $20 million in the can, and now we have this script with all these action set pieces and CG and stuff. We can't afford to do this. We've already spent $20 million, so what we need you to do is we need to get a script doctor, Ed Solomon, bring him in, and essentially cut out as, you know, $20 million worth of effects. And that script that they handed to the directors, it was just so much less that, and they had already started building the sets. They had already started designing everything. They had storyboards. So even though they had attempted to save money by rewriting the scripts, they ended up losing more money because they had to throw out those storyboards and the sets that they had built. They had to build new ones to accommodate that new script. And from what we have heard, unfortunately, almost every department went over budget except for visual effects.
Wow.
And the visual effects department, they came under budget and they said, hey, we have time. We have the money. We'd love to do some extra visual effects, you know, just polish the film. And they were considering bringing the VFX people into LA to do that, to do some final touches for the climax. Because it's a very quick, very low VFX climax, and they wanted to kind of pump it up. But ultimately, they decided, we save money. Why should we spend it? And they decided against that and put the film out.
Yeah, I do want to talk about the visual effects in a second here, but you bringing up the original script, the original idea for the movie, the Rain Man style idea, that sounds crazy, but I think Ray will agree with me. That that movie they made, like the other version of Rain Man, is The Wizard. The Wizard is like Rain Man for kids, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that even that was brought up in interviews regarding The Wizard as well, so yeah.
In 15 seconds, what is Nice Games Club?
It's our game dev podcast. Steven, help!
Game mechanics, accessibility, art and animation, level design, prototyping!
Everything that goes into making video games. How's that, Mark?
Nice. Listen to Nice Games Club wherever you get your podcasts, or at nicegames.club.
Need some adventure in your life? What Mad Universe is a podcast where two guys delve into the history of sci-fi, fantasy, and horror, and the impact it's had on pop culture.
Everything's the same politically, but we have ray guns.
The actual motive isn't to explore something that's, quote, scientifically possible.
But neither is Star Wars, and I know there's arguments about that, but I would definitely consider Star Wars science fiction.
You haven't read Dune!
No, I haven't.
You can never be the Kwisatz Haderach.
What Mad Universe on the HyperX Podcast Network.
Visual effects, it's pretty interesting to see. A lot of things curse this movie. We also have the unfortunate timing of Jurassic Park. Now, I just recorded a podcast about Jurassic Park, so I've just seen it like twice, and I have Jurassic Park on the brain. So we have this movie in May of 93, and then we have Jurassic Park in June of 93, like the biggest 1993 movie of all time. And both movie heavily feature dinosaurs, although there's not as many dinosaurs in Mario. But I will say, upon watching this movie, I will applaud the Yoshi puppet. Not enough Yoshi in this movie. The puppet is constantly chained up. It can't really go too many places, but I like seeing it, and it's a good puppet. I think it's on par with the puppet versions of like the Raptors and the Dilophosaur in Jurassic Park. They did a very good job, but you can see like a lot of the money on the screen. This is an over-budget movie, and the idea of Dino Hatton is interesting because it seems like the idea was a bit compromised and that you can't have a ton of extras with makeup and prosthetics. So there's some people with makeup. There's a few dinosaurs. It's very scattered. But when you do see an actual dinosaur, it looks like, yes, there's millions of dollars on the screen right there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And it's interesting that it came from so many different angles, that whole different departments working together to make that happen. I mean, Yoshi alone, I believe, was $500,000 to make that happen. And as opposed to Jurassic Park, I mean, it's a much smaller, more intricate thing. And it took so many puppeteers to kind of make that performance work. So you had the Yoshi, but then you had all the Goombas with the done by makeup and effects laboratory. And those are its own crazy, like, way to make that work. And then you had the Koopa puppet at the end was done by another with Rob Berman's team. And then the people with makeup, as you said, where it was almost like that wasn't even supposed to be a thing. And the makeup team, Vince Guastini, I think is the way he pronounces his last name. He kind of had a rogue unit where they were able to kind of make more stuff and make prosthetics. And the idea was like, well, these are people that have been like thrown in the Devo chamber for like minor offenses that are like partially devolved. So that's when you get some people that don't have scars, but some people that have little like scales and things popping through their faces. So that was like an on the fly thing of like, what can we do to like sell this movie that is that we might not be able to completely do the vision justice, but they wanted to do their best.
Yeah, I'm sure other people notice things besides me, but whenever I go back to the movie, I always notice like new elements of world building in the set design, in the makeup, because upon first viewing, it's a kind of a movie that's hard to follow. You can see interviews with Parker Bennett saying we weren't sure if people would understand the alternate dimension thing, so that's restated a lot by characters, especially in ADR. I'll tell you what, when I was a kid, I didn't realize they were in another dimension. I'm like, oh, they're just like through that hole under New York. I didn't realize it was like another world, a parallel world. Oh. But looking at the movie, it's just like, oh, yeah, like Koopa was like a military commander who staged a coup. And you could see there was like basically like an illegal election that happened or something like that. And then other world building details, like all of the cars run on these electric cables, presumably because dinosaurs didn't die and there's no fossil fuels, in quotes. So just like all of these ideas that are never explained. But when you go back to the movie, you can see like, oh, like there are these lore building things on the screen that are not being explained, despite how often the movie wants to explain other stuff to you.
Yeah, it does operate on some level of internal logic, and they tried to, even though it is wacky and crazy, the filmmakers and writers, they tried to do the world building to where, and not all of it, like you said, not all of it winds up on screen, but on multiple viewings. And if you're like me and Steven and put a whole website to it, you're always searching for the answers.
And one thing, I always forget to look for this when I'm watching the movie, but this came out... I was at 1UP when this story came out. I feel like you guys were behind it because I feel like one of you was messaging me when I was at that website. But before I did that podcast 10 years ago, there were the behind-the-scenes stories that were starting to come out, especially about Bob Hoskins' broken hand and how that came about, where at one point on the set, there was some drinking involved. Bob Hoskins would partake when he was having a bad time, invite John Leguizamo for a little nip. And because of that, there was an accident with the van and the door slammed shut on Bob Hoskins' hand. And so some parts of the movie, He has a cast painted look like a hand. I assume rewatching it this time, it's why he's wearing those gloves in the club scene. It's like just another way to hide his hand, although I don't know the timeline of the shooting and the broken hand. But again, a lot of things went wrong, and that was one of them.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't done a finger watch of the movie myself. I think it was just on his finger.
Okay.
Leguizamo slammed the door. And there's another really harrowing example that we heard from I think it was one of the producers. Was it Rothbard maybe that told us, Steven? Where the scene where Mario and Luigi jump off of the catwalk into the sludge gulper, when they shot that, the two stunt guys missed the sludge gulper and fell onto the ground, and like both had to go to the intensive care at the ER or whatever. They really got messed up. So and things like, you see old interviews with Bob Hoskins, and he's not just making it up. He's like, I got stabbed, I got electrocuted. Yeah, because one of the cattle prod like shockers didn't have the safety on it. He really got shocked, like in a scene. He looks like he's got paint on his face. Hoskins is a great actor, but he was probably in one of those scenes really getting zapped, not to mention the sweltering heat from the cement factory filming in that space in the summer of 1992. And it was pretty nuts.
I didn't realize, I mean, Mario and Luigi receive a lot of abuse in the movie. It is interesting to see, as like a fan of the series going back, like, wow, they are just like beaten and jailed and just in bad shape for about half the movie before they have their, they escape and they get their suits and everything. And yeah, I mean, that's another thing. Whenever I see this movie, I'm like, wow, it is the Mario prequel movie. And I don't have the specific time codes written down, but it's like you have to wait a long time before you get a Mario jump. And then the Mario and Luigi in their clothes is like the big reveal. Like, this is, they've arrived. They're the Super Mario Brothers now. In fact, that is like, they're given that title at the end of the movie. And I mean, I don't know how much was planned. I mean, they weren't really thinking like this in 1993, but as much as they are today, where there's like a roadmap of movies. But was there the idea like there will be more of these? This is just the prequel? Because from what I read in the doing research, it felt like this was always meant to be a prequel of sorts, like an origin story of sorts for the characters.
Yeah, it was always in the director's minds. It was always, this is what really happened. And then the game was made after it. And as far as a sequel hook, that was added by Parker Bennett and Terry Rente at the end. They needed a way to end the movie, and they thought, well, hey, if we write a sequel hook in, maybe they'll make a sequel, maybe we can write it. So that was, and it was, of course, like Back to the Future inspired. Even in the work print, they used Back to the Future score to kind of like underpin that. Like, yeah, it's the Back to the Future thing where there's another threat. But Steven might be able to add a little bit more to the sequel hookness.
Yeah, like you said, the sequel hook was a very last minute addition, and it wasn't so much intended to be a sequel hook as a "and so the adventure continues" type of way to just end the story. And it also referenced the ending of Back to the Future, where Doc Brown shows up. He's like, oh, your kids, we gotta go and have another adventure. And as we know, that ended up having a sequel. And they spent like the first 20 minutes just trying to get rid of the passed out girlfriend because they didn't know how to write around her.
Right.
So it's one of those instances where, yeah, they kind of implied a sequel might happen, but they had no idea where it would have actually gone. In the earlier scripts, prior to the sequel hook, there's a lot made during the merging of the dimensions, where Mario and Koopa are sort of transporting between different dimensions. And there's an interview with Rocky and Annabelle, the directors, where they're asked about a sequel. And they don't give much specifics other than, oh, in the games, there's a lot of different worlds. And in the film, there's a lot of different dimensions, too. So if we do a sequel, you can rest assured that they'll be visiting those other dimensions. Nothing specific beyond that, but it did show that they might not have been so concerned with this one little Mario-themed universe, the Mushroom Kingdom. They might have felt like they could branch out and tap into other I don't know, don't want to say that they would go to like Donkey Kong Land or anything like that, but it doesn't seem like they felt too constrained by the Mario property, that if a sequel had been made, it might not necessarily have been more true to the games. It might have diverged even more.
Interesting.
Funny. On the other hand, that also, that idea in general also does just leave it open for subcon, right? Which is like Mario 2, the game. Like, yeah, that's exactly. Basically a different dimension as well. It's not exactly the Mushroom Kingdom. So I think perhaps it would have been developed in that.
It's all very speculative, but it's easily missed that Daisy's mother, who's only very briefly shown at the very beginning of the film, she's wearing like a sort of red cloak. And according to the script, she's part of like a secret society, a cult that worships the meteorite and
Portal
kind of like an electromagnetic connection to it. And the insinuation is that this cult are the film's version of the Shy Guys. They wear these red cloaks. And Koopa's responsible for kind of committing genocide against this cult. And you're led to believe that most, if not all of them, are dead other than Daisy. She got slipped away.
Mm-hmm. That's why she has the power.
Yeah, yeah, but mm-hmm. But it's very easy to imagine, hey, what if some of them just fled into the desert? So there is a lot of opportunity, you know. As far as the scripts are concerned, they touched a lot on this cult and its the nature of it and why Daisy in particular is necessary for merging the dimensions. And it feels like if they had done a sequel, they might have kind of circled back on that, gone deeper into Daisy's background, gone into her mother and her father and their connection to this cult. So I do think you're on the right track as far as subcon being a potential plot line.
Yeah, upon reading your Parker Bennett interview, it did answer a lot of questions, but also raise more questions that I didn't really think about, where I think he even admits like, oh yeah, we never really explained why Daisy had this power, and other things like, oh yeah, Iggy and Spike are at the end of the movie because they don't really get an ending in the movie proper. They are jailed. And that's it for them. And then suddenly they're in Mario and Luigi's apartment giving an interview with, talking to two Japanese businessmen for some reason. But yeah, there's so much going on in the movie, like story-wise, that you can see they're trying to patch all of these holes in the story that are were there because of budget, were there because of, different drafts. There are just a lot of things that I always think about. It's like, Koopa's plan, I mean, I think even Parker Bennett admits, like, yeah, there's not a lot of logic to some of this, where Koopa's plan is like, I'll merge the dimensions and then I'll rule the world or something. It's just my own thought is, and I'm thinking too much about this, but I'm a podcaster, just like, if Koopa makes it to the real world, what's the guarantee that's still him? Isn't the real world version of Koopa going to merge with him? I could be thinking about this too literally, but...
Oh, yeah, merge logic is not... Yeah, it's a little difficult.
I think the issue... For me, is like, I love Back to the Future. Like, it's my favorite movie series. And they are very careful to explain with like a literal diagram, like, here is what an alternate world means. And we come into this movie with that knowledge because we've all seen that Back to the Future too. But the movie still needs a chalkboard segment. We still need... For the idea of parallel worlds to really make sense, we need to see, like, well, what is this version of Mario? What is this version of Luigi? And I think that's why, as a kid, I never thought, like, they're in a parallel world, because in my mind, 1985A, there's, like, a different Biff, and there's a different Marty and all this stuff, and some people are dead and some people are alive. But they don't really commit to that idea, and I'm just doing script doctoring at this point, but... There's a lot of issues with the story itself that really prevent it from being coherent.
Yeah, the scripts are very unclear. You know, it says parallel dimension here, it says subdimension there. You're never quite clear on the nature of this other world. And, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, you're going to merge the dimensions. What does that mean? So you're going to merge that entire wasteland onto our dimension? And, you know, there's some implication that, oh, actually Koopa is only merging the one city. He has this gigantic grid network
where the power is.
Yeah. And he's only going to merge this one city in over New York City, and the subdimension's still going to exist. They're not really merging the dimensions. He's just merging a piece of it.
He's just like,
it's just not clear, like you said.
Kind of copy pasting.
They ever quite determined.
Yeah.
He's kind of copy pasting Dino Hatton over Manhattan.
And on some level, too, it is looking at the game analog version of it. He is a villain. He is kind of this, he's a dictator in a position that shouldn't be a dictator, and he's just doing whatever he wants, and he's an evil a-hole, you know? And he kind of doesn't know exactly what's going to happen and probably doesn't really care as long as he gets to, as he merges the dimensions, that's what he can do. He gets off that world and he's going to rule. I mean, and at the end of the day, that kind of, that force of chaos destructor kind of guy, that like is enough for me, like as a game analog to like King Bowser or King Koopa, to for that part of it to make sense, even though the internal logic of the movie I kind of just have to go with.
Yeah, it's a shame. I feel like if they had more money and more time, a third act would be Koopa isn't in the real world. Let's stop him instead of...
That's what it was.
Oh, okay. I assume so.
He was a giant... See, I'm wearing the shirt. He was like the giant Koopa monster with a giant tail, and he was crawling up the Brooklyn Bridge, and Mario had to fight him, and it was going to be this insane, like...
Yeah, they actually built a model Brooklyn Bridge. Never got to use it.
Wow.
And he was going to kill Koopa by he was going to have a long tongue like Yoshi, only the more awful like Resident Evil liquor version of it, and Mario was going to throw like a ba-bomb, and he was going to eat the ba-bomb and explode at the end or something like that.
Because as it stands in the movie, the third act, it's he comes to our world for about 30 seconds. It's shockingly brief. He turns one guy into a monkey and that's about it. Yeah. So I feel like if they had money, and clearly they had bigger plans, like he just does not seem to be that big of a threat for the villain of this film, for sure.
Yeah, they were constantly cutting down the script to accommodate a lower budget climax. The original plan was a Brooklyn Bridge set piece, but after that, they were going to have the characters merge into Times Square and have a huge battle in Times Square. Koopas Goombas transforming everyone into monkeys, that sort of thing. And then they realized we can't have another set that's, you know, how are we going to do Times Square? So let's just do the set we already have, the dig site.
Yeah, which the dirt lot.
Doesn't make any sense. Like, you have the characters merging from, Koopa and Mario merging from Koopa Square to the dig site when they should be merging into Times Square. So,
right. But they wanted to use the sets that they had.
Mm-hmm. It just became less and less sensical because of the budget.
I've always been fascinated by the surprising lack of, even though that Dennis Hopper is very like imposing and threatening as Koopa in the film, there's a surprising lack of direct physical interaction between Koopa and others. Like, it's always like sending you to the Devo chamber. I'm doing this, I'm doing that. Like, Mario and Koopa don't actually, like, they almost, like, if you watch the movie again, they almost start to fight, and he reaches for the rock, the fake rock that he thinks Mario has, and then they start to merge. That wasn't, because he's kind of a germaphobe too, and he kind of like sends others to do his dirty work.
Oh, yeah.
And that wasn't always the case in other scripts. Like, he is like this, like, I'm going to grab you with my iron fist kind of guy. And I don't know if that was more on the script side or if that was a Dennis Hopper thing, but I haven't been able to track like how that slight shift happened in the character, but it is very interesting.
Yeah. They are separated for most of the movie. I was rewatching it for our commentary and I was like, wait, why is he disguised as the lawyer? Like for a 1 minute ruse. And my pal Henry was like, well, otherwise he would not be in contact with Mario for the entire movie. And I was like, oh, good point. Good point. In recent years, you folks discovered I believe it was sent to you, but a work print of the movie with about 15 minutes of deleted scenes. How much did those add, and do you think that they should be restored, or do you think they were cut for the correct reasons?
It's very interesting. It's the shining example of like why the site exists for things like this to happen. We had always, based on the scripts and people we've talked to, we've always knew that there was more of the movie. I mean, it's true for most movies, right? They film more than they get released, and with all the ADR that happened, I feel like there's a better version of the movie out there, but really, it's really just for us. Like, I think it adds a lot. But for me, it adds a lot because the deleted scenes that are in there make characters a little bit more interesting. It does put a little bit more of that edge back into it that some of the earlier scripts had. So it makes sense why things were cut or trimmed. And it changes some characters entirely. It gives Iggy and Spike an entire other story. Like, they could have been part of the sequel in terms of how things happened. And, but yeah, the guy that found that was able to get the VHS tape, got it for the right reasons and became a partner with us. And we were able to get it, that work print tape scanned and restored as best we could. And it's been released online in a few various versions. You know, it's up on the Internet Archive, but we've also been able to get it on the most recent, it's a special feature. We worked with Umbrella Entertainment on their recent Blu-ray release. So you can watch it right now. You can see the extra footage. And we've also got clips on our YouTube where we actually take out the deleted scenes and explain like what they are and why it's cool and where it references other scripts and things like that. So for us, it's definitely a cool curiosity and it makes the film better. But for the general moviegoer, it probably wouldn't make a huge difference.
Yeah.
Oh, Ray, I heard you trying to jump in earlier.
Oh, yeah. No, I also watched that version because, you know, another reason to watch the movie. I'll take it. And yeah, it was really interesting. I would say I'm in agreement with Ryan there. As a fan of the movie, I was really happy to see it. I'm glad someone put it together. I am so excited it exists. I don't fully agree it makes the movie better, having all those scenes restored, especially the rap scene. And my apologies to Richard Edson. I'm sure they tried to make the best of a bad situation there. But that one in particular just stuck out to me. Like, yeah, this didn't need to be there. And but nonetheless, I would say it is a great thing that stuff was found. And because also I remember seeing like some of those cut scenes from the trading cards.
Exactly.
Like I said,
that was our only reference for a while. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is a thing that happens, I think, with a lot of movies. You get trading cards that referencing scenes that ultimately get cut. And this was one of them. And yeah. So to finally get that, to see those scenes in motion, finally, was very cool in general. So yeah.
Or they'll like even be in the trailer for the movie. They'll never be in the final movie.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. We even had, and that was another thing we did a few years ago. I had film of the trailers, and we've got some great people here in Raleigh, and he was able to 4K scan some of the trailers, so we were able to get really nice things. So like even at our Alamo Draft House, like before the Sonic movie a couple years ago, they're like playing the 4K restored Mario trailer.
Oh, awesome.
So it's cool to see that stuff up on the big screen. And you know, even having screenings of the film a few years ago at Thalian Hall, like we were able to screen the film versions of the trailers and the movie. And it's just a cool experience to see this kind of stuff up on the big screen, because it's bringing that era back, you know?
You know, speaking of cut content, I'm only half kidding about this. I honestly feel like this movie invented Wario and Waluigi before Nintendo did, or around the same time, because when looking at the Scapelli brothers, I'm like, well, this is Wario and Waluigi. These are the evil counterparts to Mario and Luigi. And I assume there's more on the cutting room floor and in deleted scenes, but it's just like that is another very underplayed part of the movie where these guys are like in there stealing all the plumbing jobs, but they play such a minor role and they should be like the real world villains. And I guess one gets their comeuppance, but it's just an element of the movie where you feel like there was a lot more there before the movie took its final form.
Yeah.
I would ask you this, Bob. Do you think maybe Lena was some sort of prototypical version of Bowsette?
Oh, wow. You know what? I buy this theory now.
Okay.
And if more people know
it. I'm also half kidding.
No, listen, if more people knew that, I think the movie will be more popular.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Especially online. Yeah, Lena, that is one character where I was just thinking, well, she has no basis in the game at all. Like, there was no character like her. You know, Iggy and Spike, another confusing pair, where Iggy Koopa is a Koopa kid. Spike is the name of an enemy, but they're not Koopa kids. They're cousins. Just the mishmash of references, the grab bag, if you will, is very fascinating to see some of the major things they barely touch. Like, I guess some things are recontextualized. Like, there's no fire flowers, but there are fire flamethrowers. Like,
yep.
Things are given a very literal take in this movie, a very, like, organic take. And
they have one super mushroom. As soon as Mario trusts the fungus, then he's got a mushroom.
And much like in the game,
and he powers up, and even when they re-merge, he has the mushroom, and he grows bigger as they merge back.
That is something I caught the second time I watched it for this viewing. I was like, oh, for some reason, either Koopa shrinks or he grows. It's hard to tell, but I think he became Super Mario.
Yep,
temporarily. Yeah. But I mean, like, I want to ask Ryan and Steven before we go here, what was the most surprising part of this journey for each of you, like, in terms of, like, a certain discovery? Because, again, like, learning about the murder of the other screenwriter, I was shocked. I was not expecting to find that story attached to a Super Mario Brothers movie. For both of you, what was the most surprising or most interesting discovery you made on this very long journey you've both been taking?
It's tough because it's weird to say at this point. We've had so many ridiculous blessings in going through this process. And I guess as a whole for me, it's just been, I have not really interacted with anybody that has worked on the film, that's provided things for us or talked to us or been included with the site, that does not remember that experience as something very profound in their lives, good or bad, or nobody's indifferent. You know, everybody has a story, and it seems like it's really cool that it's been pretty gratifying to have a place on the internet to kind of hold this knowledge and hold the story of this film and the people that worked on it, because that was the mission the whole time. Just to, yeah, it's fun to dunk on it or whatever, but like dunk on it with context. Mm-hmm. Respect, you know, this is the internet.
Yeah.
So that's been, and every time I think we've found everything, you know, somebody turns up with the work print that we thought we would never find. And then it just goes on the Blu-ray, and people like that you never think you would really get to, that would care that much, you know, do things for you, like Roland Joffe recording a interview for us for the Blu-ray, or John Leguizamo recording a special anniversary video just so we could put it on our YouTube and things like that. And then that combined with the ridiculously passionate fans that message us all the time on Twitter and Facebook, that people are just kind of understand at this point that it's fun to be a fan of this iteration of Mario Brothers. And so, yeah, it's hard to pinpoint one thing.
Yeah, I will say that poring over the many interviews and things you guys have done over the years, it's very nice to see that while many people who worked on the movie don't think it's good, they are just happy and grateful to see that somebody cares and to remember this very strange and interesting time in their life, just having fun in North Carolina and wondering, like, what are we doing here? What are we making? Steven, have you had any, like, really interesting finds along your way, this journey of researching the movie?
Not for me personally, but a story that does stand out is, come across a lot on Twitter, and this was a few years ago, but voice actor AJ Locasio, he happened to find like a whole binder full of the film's storyboards in the gutter in LA.
Literally in the gutter.
Wow.
The street, he looked over, he saw a binder, and it said Super Mario Brothers. He opens it up. It's a bunch of storyboards. It's completely bizarre. But he sent it to us. We got all the scans of it. Some of it we already had, some of it we didn't. But it just goes to show that, you know, for as long as we've been doing it, we've always been scared that things were just thrown out. There was a time where I was calling up Leitmotiv Studios like every week to say, hey, because can I get into your storage facility? Can we ask about your whatever materials you might still have. And it finally got to a point after like 2 years of calling, they finally answered and they're like, yeah, we shut down the company a month ago. We liquidated the storage facility. Everything was thrown out. I'm like, I've been calling you for 2 years.
Yeah,
geez. That's heartbreaking.
Then, you know, the work print showed up, the storyboards show up in the gutter. Things keep still showing up. And it's just utterly fascinating to see what people have still held on to. The, like, the props in particular, there's a lot of those props were made of, like, the boots, for example, were made of foam. They just tossed them into a dumpster behind the cement factory when they were done. And you would imagine most of them were destroyed, but we found like 4 or 5 pairs of Thwomp Stomper boots so far. So it seems like some people had the wherewithal to hold on to these things. And one of the people on our site, Blake Dumasnil, he has a pretty good collection of materials, mostly props. He's been able to get in touch with a lot of people, prop makers in the industry as well, who have materials from the film. I mean, that's pretty interesting to discover that actual film industry veterans are interested enough in the film that they themselves are collecting it. But it's just a very interesting artifact and uncovering what still remains and how it all ties together. It's just been a very satisfying process for me.
That's great. Like I said up front, there are still so many mysteries to solve about this movie. And the work print that was discovered is only 3 years old. I'm not sure if this has happened to either of you, Ryan and Steve, Stephen, but have you ever taken a field trip? Was there a North Carolina trip to the shooting locations? Is that still in your future?
Well, I mean, I've taken field trips to where Stephen is. He's in California, so we've had some screenings there, and we've had people come out. We've had props. Like, Stephen was actually able to go to Rob Berman's warehouse and lug giant Koopa heads, bucket heads in his vehicle to the theater. And if you go to the website and look that stuff up, it was kind of a magical experience. I live in Raleigh, so I'm only a drive away from Wilmington. So I have driven there. I have gone to the cement factory. A few years ago, we had a screening at Thalian Hall in Wilmington. And a lot of people that worked on the film, and Wilmington loves their film industry. They really support it. And a lot of people came out to that screening and were able to, you know, reminisce and tell stories and talk to me about things. And we had props there and everything like that. And you can even, if anybody else does make the trek, you can go to the bar Barbary Coast. They have the section from the set of Lena's fossilized skeleton on the wall. So you can go into this bar and there's like a giant like skeleton there, like from the movie. They excised it from the set and it's still up in that bar.
I need to send co-host Jeremy Parrish there. He lives in Raleigh. He doesn't know how close he is to the Super Mario Brothers stomping grounds.
I know. He needs to watch the movie first. So then he can.
We will find a way.
It would be great.
We'll find a way to make him. He doesn't know how close he is to history. But we have to wrap up. Thank you, Ryan and Stephen and Ray. I do want to end this discussion with everyone's thoughts. What do you think the legacy of this movie is? And also, what are your hopes for this new Mario movie, if you care? Ray, how about you?
Legacy. I think a lot of that has been evident, like I said, in maybe the recent decade, ever since these guys' website got started and started growing, is that we have basically a younger generation. I mean, our guests are just a few years younger than us, Bob, but I think that's enough.
I think so.
Because
I'll take it.
And even like people a few years younger than all of us, like, have started to really appreciate the movie, and they get excited about things like, oh man, this aesthetic rules, and this is like a great example of this kind of era of filmmaking, and so on and so forth. And you get people appreciating it on that level, and people who definitely were not probably even alive when the movie came out, and were not even conscious of even like the reviews back then, like we were. And so I think that legacy is just like a cool looking movie, mm-hmm. with some fascinating production story is probably like the best legacy you could possibly have at this point.
Steven, how about you?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I feel it will help people realize what they were going for with the original film. It seems like it might be a little more by the numbers, a little more traditional. And the original film was intended to be deconstructive and subversive. They were trying to, they were overthinking the material. So I feel like if we get a more standard, straight carbon copy adaptation, people will appreciate what the original was going for a little more. I do have my worries. I don't think it's a straight comparison, but I'm a huge fan of the Jim Carrey Grinch film. And then Illumination later came out with an animated adaptation, which I did not like. So I'm very fearful it'll be the same situation. I just feel the live action version of How the Grinch Stole Christmas really captured what the Grinch was about. Like in the remake, the animated remake, the Grinch just hates Christmas because he's a Pooh Bear. Like they didn't really care too much. It was just more of a straight adaptation, and I'm hoping that they'll be a bit more bold with the Mario adaptation.
Okay, I have reservations too, but first, Ryan, what are your thoughts on the legacy of the first movie and any thoughts on the upcoming movie?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I think I'm endlessly fascinated by the Super Mario Brothers movie, because it does hit this really, we'll never have that time again in filmmaking and in the history of filmmaking and in the history of video games, where it was this inflection point between traditional filmmaking approaches and the digital stuff and it's right in the middle where you've got like a lot of burgeoning CG and puppetry and prosthetics and all that work. It's actually, even technically, it's the first movie to use digital intermediates, which is an industry standard thing now, but Mario Brothers was the first movie to do that. So it's kind of a pioneer in that way, and that's another overlooked little tidbit there. So yeah, just that, not only that aspect of it, but just the aspect of it being the first video game adaptation, and it's a very interesting look at the art of adapting something from one form of media to another, and it's definitely not one of the by the numbers thing. It's one of the standout examples of what could be possible, or good choices, bad choices. It's just will always be a fascinating case study on it. And so that's the legacy, is everything wrapped up into how it got made and why it got made. And that's why the website exists. As for the new movie, like Steven, I'm cautiously optimistic. I don't think I'm worried it'll feel overproduced or just too by the numbers, but we'll see. The casting announcements lead me to believe that there's more world building than you might think, with Donkey Kong and things like that. And it'll be interesting. And when the film, and at the end of the day, like when that film was announced and the casting was announced, people went nuts on our social media. Like, oh, let's talk about the old movie. Like, we're going to appreciate that now. And I think the audience that's grown up with the film, or even after the film's been released, is a little bit more sophisticated now, or is willing to go back and look at this old stuff with the new light, because the people that were kids when the movie came out are now parents. And so those are the kind of parents that will take their kids to a Mario movie, whether it's for them or not.
Yeah, I'm thinking you might see a rush of new fans, kids born in like the aughts who don't know there was another Mario movie, or are, you know, are just finding out. But yeah, my thoughts are very brief. Like this movie, the 93 movie, it's a movie that this thing cannot happen today. There are things in place where this kind of movie cannot happen. So it's interesting to see a time when it did happen, and it happened extravagantly. And, you know, it has a lot of problems, but if you watch it with an open mind, you can appreciate many elements of it. And if you have any questions, you have to go immediately to the Super Mario Brothers movie archive, and most of them will be answered. Again, there are still lingering questions. We'll get to them. Hopefully in the future, there'll be more storyboard art fairies who will drop things off in gutters to solve more, answer more questions.
I want to add real quick, I didn't actually answer your second question about the new movie.
Oh, sure.
All I will say really is that no matter what, I think I'm going to be too old for it, and that's okay.
Me too.
Yeah.
I turned 40 before the movie comes out, so I'm definitely too old for it. But yeah, my thoughts on that one are like, to me, the Mario characters and universe are what Star Wars is and like Marvel is to other people. Like, I'm really into it. I know a ton about it. I'm invested in it, but I don't expect this movie to be for me. I'm going to give it a chance. I think Bob Hoskins is a better casting than Chris Pratt, but who knows? Maybe he'll surprise me. I'm just happy that at least we'll get one every 30 years, so maybe I'll get to see one more Mario movie before I die. I don't think I'll make it to 101, but maybe I'll surprise you. Who knows? But this has been another episode of Retronauts. Thanks for joining us, everybody. I'll let you know where to find us online. Of course, you can find us on Twitter as @Retronauts. And of course, we are part of the HyperX Podcast Network. And we are also fan supported on Patreon at patreon.com/Retronauts. Sign up there for $3 a month. You get access to all these episodes 1 week at a time and ad free. And for $5 a month, you get 2 full-length bonus episodes every month and a weekly column and podcast by our contributor Diamond Fight. And guess what, folks? That Mario Brothers movie commentary is on the $5 level posted earlier this month. So if you want that as like the nice, the fun dessert after this serious Mario discussion, that's out there too if you want to check that out. But it's all happening at patreon.com/retronauts. Let's go around the virtual room here. You can let us know where to find you. Let's start with Ray. Ray, what's going on with you?
Sure. I'm on Twitter and Twitch as RDBAAA. I have a game company called Bipedal Dog. I also do the podcast No More Whoppers here on our network, along with my friend Alex Fraioli, who I will add just saw the Super Mario Brothers movie recently as part of a friend's double feature of Fisher Stevens. He watched that alongside Hackers.
I was going to say Hackers. It's probably Hackers.
Yep. I guess that's the way to do it. Have your own Fisher Stevens double feature. That's at nomorewhoppers.com, our show.
Ryan, how about you?
The Super Mario Brothers the Movie Archive website is online at smbmovie.com, and we're on Twitter at SMB Movie. Steven is usually the guy that's always hashtagging Trust the Fungus to you. Sometimes I'll do it, and I'll pop in there. You can also follow my personal Twitter at SMB_Ryan. I'm, as I mentioned at the top of the show, I'm in the game industry. I'm a VFX artist, but I also do a lot of Batman stuff. I like Batman. I podcast with Batman on film, and I do a Robin Tim Drake podcast also. And so I'm kind of in that world as well. So,
and Steven, do you have any plugs?
Just re-adding that on Twitter, you can find us at SMB Movie, but we are also on Facebook, Super Mario Brothers the Movie Archive. Both are pretty active every day. Lots of Mario news. We'd love to have you join us.
Awesome. Looking forward to what is coming next. And as for me, I do other podcasts. You probably know about them, but if you don't, I do Talking Simpsons. It's a chronological exploration of The Simpsons and What a Cartoon, where we look at a different cartoon from a different series every month. You can find those wherever you find podcasts or go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. We have a $5 level there. You get access to all of our exclusive miniseries and monthly episodes of both Talking Futurama and Talking of the Hill happening at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. That's it for us for this week. We'll see you again very soon for another episode of Retronauts. Take care.